We're looking at the influence of Christians. That's what the sermon is about tonight. And if you look at Matthew chapter 5, we're going to look at verses 13 through 16. And these read, "You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt has become tasteless, how can it be made salty again? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden. Nor does anyone light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on the lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light shine before men in such a way that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven." Now, the passages that are commonly referred to as the Beatitudes in verses 3 through 11 of Matthew 5 concern the character of disciples. But then the text shifts from that to how these disciples will be an influence in the world. Now, where the other verses are called the Beatitudes, well, sometimes the ones that follow about the salt and light are called the similitudes. And that's a word that means similarity or resemblance, or one closely resembling another, a counterpart. And most of the time, whenever there's a similitude, they're prefaced by the word like or as. And so we use these all of the time when we're describing something being like or as something else. That's what we're doing, even if you didn't know that's what it was called. But that's what these are in Matthew chapter 5, verses 13 and 16. So it's a similarity that's made between one thing and another. Now, in these things, and by the way, let me say, I really think if we will kind of put ourselves in the setting of the time of the New Testament, and when Jesus was about to deliver the Sermon on the Mount, we might be able to appreciate the fact that this sermon and what these people were going to hear to them was going to be radical and revolutionary. They had never heard anything like this before. It went against a lot of things, not everything, but a lot of things that they took for granted and had accepted and had been commonplace for all of their lives, if not even for their parents' lives. And Jesus is actually laying down the groundwork for the kingdom that would come, and it would be radically different from everything that existed and everything that had existed, and it would also be revolutionary in its scope. Now, one of the things that he deals with here in talking about the salt and the light is how the world reacts to disciples of Christ. And really, when you think about this reaction, and there's a lot of things that we could look at. Matter of fact, we could probably have a sermon just in and of itself as the reaction comes towards those who are Christians. But there's no passage that's any clearer on this than what you find in John chapter 15 and in verse 18. The passage says, "If the world hates you, you know that it has hated me before it hated you." So that passage is pretty clear about it. The world reaction to Christians is based on their reaction to Jesus Christ. They hate him. They hate his followers. And that's not all that John had to say on this subject. If you go to 1 John chapter 3. Now look at what's said there in verse 13. 1 John chapter 3, verse 13. "Do not be surprised, brethren, if the world hates you." Well, he's saying about the same thing he did back here in John 15. But then we see that the reason for this hatred is explained in verse 12. "Not as Cain, who was of the evil one, slew his brother. And for what reason did he slay him? Because his deeds were evil and his brothers were righteous." Is that why he did this? Yeah, why is it that the world hates you? It's because your deeds are righteous and theirs are not. And so they hate you for this. So we look at the, you put this all together and you find out, well, now the world's reaction towards disciples is, well, they hate disciples because they hate Christ. And they hate disciples because disciples' actions are righteous and they know that. Now they know it. Now, they can play ignorant all they want. They can do whatever, however they want to do this. But they know what the difference is. They know that these actions of disciples are righteous and what they're doing is not. And then I also think that it's important. I was trying to remember what version of the Bible it was. I didn't have, by the time I thought about it, I didn't have time to look. 1 Corinthians chapter 4. I'll explain that. It's got it right in here. If you look at a lot of versions of the Bible, now first I got up there, it's important to notice that those who are the hope of the world are not viewed that way at all. A lot of passages or a lot of versions of the Bible are kind of unclear about 1 Corinthians 4, verse 13. It'll have different wording in there and so on. But there are a few that have it right, and the New American Standard's one of them. It says, when we are slandered, we try to conciliate. We have become as the scum of the world, the dregs of all things, even until now. Now, that doesn't mean that we actually are the scum of the world. It means that's how the world looks at Christians, as though they're the scum of the world, the scum of the earth. Now, some passages, I think the King James Version, the old translation, has the off-scouring of the world. Well, what's off-scouring? It's kind of lost on us, but this is pretty clear. And it's where water or something goes sour or bad or however it is, and that's the part that you knock off. It's the off scouring. That's what the word actually meant back in the King James Version. But now that's really something. The ones who are the hope of the world looks at those who are the hope of the world as being the scum of the earth. And then, if we go forward, fast forward from the first century to now, don't we see how this attitude towards Christians still exists? It does. And in our ultra sensitive, politically correct culture today, there's only one group that's fair game for discrimination and verbal persecution of every kind, and you'll never be called down if it's directed toward Christians. Now, it's amazing to me that, everybody is so guarded about everything that they say because there's somebody someplace somewhere that's going to be offended by this, and then everybody will just have a meltdown over it. But boy, I'll tell you what, when it comes to Christian, it's open season. And nobody's worried about that. Nobody's apologizing about that. Most people are just laughing up their sleeves over this. And I think that we see precedent for it, certainly in some of these passages that we've looked at. One needs to accept the reality that being salt and light is necessary. And yes, you can say based on what Jesus had to say, it's even commanded. Sure, that's fine. But now there's not anywhere where we're told that this is something that's going to be easy, because it's not easy to be a disciple of Jesus Christ. The sociological setting of the time. If you go back to Matthew chapter 4, in Matthew chapter 4, you find out that this takes place on a hillside in Galilee. Jesus was going throughout all Galilee, teaching in their synagogues, proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom and healing every kind of disease and every kind of sickness among the people. It was on a mount, so it's called a mount there in chapter 5, verse 1, a mountain. It probably wasn't a mountain like we think a mountain's a mountain. Mountain in the New Testament was a high place, but this would have been a high enough place and it would have been grassy where the people could have sat down out there, and it would have been, you know, kind of a level place high up, and that's where they all gathered. But his audience was composed of the common people of the area. That's why at the end of him speaking in chapter 7, it says that the common people, people were just amazed. And of course, the common people always did listen to Jesus, listen to him gladly, because he talked in a language and in a way in which they were familiar. Now, many of them, these ones in the audience, they were without ways and means. They would have been common people. They would have been people who would have, many of them, been impoverished. But nevertheless, now, they were an important people, that kind of thing. But they were told, you're going to influence the world. To many of them, that must have seemed like something that someone just made up. How's that possible? How are we going to influence the world? But that's what Jesus had said in verses 13 through 16 of Matthew 5, wasn't it? That's exactly what he said. They would understand what he was saying. The how of it might have just escaped them. They couldn't imagine this. And at the time, it may have even seemed absurd to the people who heard this. But you know, there had been a time when there were people that came along, and you wouldn't think this would happen. But they kind of stirred up some people on other occasions. Now, not Christians, but look at, not always Christians, but Acts chapter 5, in verses 35 through 37. Now, Gamaliel, who was a teacher of the Jews, brought this up. He said to them, "Men of Israel, take care what you propose to do with these men. For some time ago, Theudas rose up, claiming to be somebody, and a group of about 400 men joined up with him. But he was killed, and all who followed him were dispersed and came to nothing. After this man, Judas of Galilee rose up in the days of the census and drew away some people after him. He too perished, and all those who followed him were scattered." Well, that happened before. You know, his line of thinking is, there's been others who've come along, and they've stirred up the people momentarily. But what happened was, when the leader was gone, well, the movement kind of dried up, went away. So he's advising them just to wait a while. This will all die of itself. After all, Jesus was crucified and buried. We don't have to worry about him anymore. He's not around. And it'll all go away. Well, of course, we realize that it didn't. And so some may have thought that the prospects might be different somewhat, but that's not the case. What we really find out is that history shows us something entirely different, doesn't it? The Roman Empire collapsed. Plato's Academy closed its doors. The philosophers, the schools of the Stoics and the Epicureans, became a faded curiosity. If it were not for mention of them in the Bible, no one would know anything about them. The great library at Alexandria burned to the ground. And yet, the disciples of Christ still exist today. And they that are around today were actually prophesied from old times as never failing. All the way back in the Old Testament book of Daniel, in Daniel chapter 2, after describing the world's great kingdoms up to that point in time, and even looking into the future, Daniel says in verse 44, "In the days of those kings," that would have been the Roman kings, "the God of heaven will set up a kingdom," that's the fifth kingdom in the prophecies here, "we will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed." Now, the kingdoms of these others, you know, the Babylonians and the Medo-Persians, the Greek and the Romans, they all fell. They were all destroyed, gone away. One conquered another, so to speak, in most of those cases. But this is a kingdom which shall never be destroyed, and that kingdom will not be left for another people. It will crush and put an end to all these kingdoms, but it will itself endure forever. That would be the church. And it would endure forever. And even in the New Testament, we find in Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 28, I think, something that goes along with this, where it says, "Therefore, since we receive a kingdom which cannot be shaken, let us show gratitude by which we may offer to God an acceptable service with reverence and awe." And so, once again, that means it won't be shaken. What would shake it? Well, nothing will shake it, because it is that which cannot be destroyed. And in Matthew chapter 16, the statement there, now this confounds what Gamaliel had to say. When Jesus is commanding Peter for what he had to say in Matthew chapter 16, verse 18, "Upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not overpower it." The gates of Hades referred to the grave, to death. Now, Gamaliel was right when he talked about all these other things, and when the leader died, it pretty well ended the movement. But that's not going to be the case, and Jesus says here that death won't change one thing about the kingdom, about the church that he was going to build. And so this is kind of the setting of what's going on and what Jesus is saying, what he's promising here, and the impact of everything that's going to happen. Now, when you get over here to the similitudes themselves, now this was something that everyone was familiar with when he talks about the salt and the light thing. Actually, every home had salt in it, and it was used as different things, preservative, flavoring, a little bit of both in there, mostly preservative, and it happened to flavor things somewhat. Every home had a lamp in it, in there to dispel darkness. We all understand that kind of a thing. Excuse me. But now, you got to think of both of these in the context of being in the world. You're the salt of the earth. You're the light of the world. And what it means there is that the world, due to sin, is kind of rotting in the dark. And you know that's happening. It's kind of unpleasant now to think about it, but I was reading something in a book the other day and commenting on this. A man said, now here's how it's like with the world. You may not know exactly where it's at and be able to put your finger, you know, really and pinpoint the right thing just right off the start, but you know there's something wrong. Now, his example was, did you ever open up the pantry door and you've got a rotten potato in there? Yeah, I'm sure all of us have done that. You know there's a rotten potato and you don't have to see it or actually pinpoint, or, you know, right there it is. You know it's in there. That's how sin is. It's like that potato in there rotting in the dark of the pantry. We know it's there. People know it's there. Even those people who are in the world know that that's what's going on. It's always been a point of just absolute fascination to me that we've got so many people in the world that are wringing their hands over the state of things. They're concerned about this and they're concerned about the other. Oh, we're so concerned about the family and homes and the breakup of family and homes and about the children and it's about this and about crime and everything that goes on. Everybody's worked up about this and they're all so concerned about it and wringing their hands and carrying on. Of course, the hand wringing, you're not doing much except wringing your hands. But that's what goes on. The wringing of hands, gnashing of teeth, like the Bible says sometimes. And I think to myself, well, okay, so you know what's going on. Because you're concerned about this. And even people that might be full of the world right up to their hairline on their forehead know that there's a problem here. But now the same people who are sitting there wringing their hands over this problem have no regard for the Bible at all. Where the solution's at. They don't want to go. They'll try everything else under the sun. But that Bible, no, we can't have that. We've got to get God out of our homes and out of our schools. And, well, we want God just completely out of the country if we could do that. And think that somehow or another that's going to make things better. As I said, I'm fascinated by this. Because I think it's just the craziest thing I've ever heard of in my life. But there are multiplied millions of people who think, oh, well, that's right. The Bible's not really the solution in some people's mind. The Bible's a problem. But now those who are Christians are the light of the world, the salt of the earth. Why? Because they're willing to follow the gospel of Jesus Christ. Christians are to be an influence. Let me catch up here. Christians are to be an influence in alleviating this problem of sin. By pointing out that this is the answer, this is what's right. And again, this is all accomplished through the gospel of Christ. It's the power of God to salvation. And it's for the Jew first, also for the Greek. You know, it's something that's for everyone. And everyone can turn to it and look at it. And therein, in that gospel, that's in the next verse, Romans chapter 1, verse 17. Therein is the righteousness of God revealed from faith to faith, as it is written, the just shall live by faith. So there's the answer. Why don't look at it once in a while? But that's what we're supposed to do. Point people to this. Encourage people to look at this. You see, we're supposed to have an influence. It doesn't mean that we go out here and, you know, now you as one person are going to go out here, or any one person is just going to go out here and convert the world. Keep in mind that Jesus didn't convert the world. Now, he may have talked to everyone that he ever met, but even then he didn't convert everyone. But he did convert some, and he did point some in the right direction. And really, that's what we're supposed to do. We're supposed to be an influence on this. And if you want to put light in a room, I think that's the easiest one. But if you want to put light in a room, and you come over here, now the lamp or the candle or whatever it's called, whatever translation you have, it was really a little more than in a poor person's house, a bowl. It's a little more than that. And it might come up to a little bit of a neck at the top of it. And then they'd have a wick in there. Now, their wick might just be a strip of cloth that's twisted together real tight. And it's dipped down in there just enough to draw out the oil that was in the bowl, and they would light that. Pretty crude light. But any light is a good light when it's dark. If you don't believe me, try being in total darkness sometime. You'd be surprised how a flicker of light looks like, you know, a lighthouse on the East Coast. But anyway, if you've got this little bit of light in the room, you don't go over there and hide it. You don't put it under a basket, a bushel, or hide it under a bed or something like that. You put it out there, you know, where you can do good. And you put it out kind of in a prominent place. You don't really put it over here in a corner somewhere. You put it out in a strategic location where it can light up all of the room as much as it possibly could. But I think sometimes as Christians we think, you know, we've got to hide ourselves away. That somehow or another we need to kind of be withdrawn and not be an influence. And we do this sometimes in a lot of ways, and in some ways in which we think we're doing a good thing. But it might not necessarily be that good thing. Now, it's possible for us to lose our ability to be an influence. And it even says that if salt loses its flavor, how shall it be seasoned? It is then good for nothing, be thrown out, trampled underfoot by men. That's for the salt part of it, you know. Now, salt can actually, well, it doesn't cease being salty. That's not what happens. most of the time, salt loses its power because it draws moisture, or it bonds with other elements and becomes, for all intents and purposes, useless. The admixture of other elements can cause it to be useless. And actually, there was plenty of salt at the Dead Sea. They had lots of that there. But the problem was they had also at the Dead Sea, they had sulfur and bitumen, and there were other raw materials that mixed with the salt, and it so diluted the salt that and polluted it that it became, well, it just became useless. And so you just threw it out and it was trampled underfoot. It became good for nothing more than maybe just a little traction when people walked on it. Now, here's the point, though. Let me catch up. If there was an admixture of worldly elements to our salt, that would be to you and me, then it will become diluted, our influence, and it will be polluted. And it would only be good to be thrown out. It won't be any good to anybody anymore because we've done this. I see things and I wonder about some of them. And sometimes it's not even acceptable among brethren, you know, to bring up certain things. Our kids went to public school. We didn't homeschool, never thought about that. Of course, when they started school, it wasn't something that was available and wasn't very popular. Didn't make any difference. They could go to public school, and yes, I understand the things that go on at public school. They went on there as much as they do today. But I hoped we'd be able to teach our kids the difference between right and wrong, and they could go to public school, and maybe they could be salt and light to others. I knew if we kept them home, they wouldn't be. And of both of our children, the only one that ever had a that came down to finally just push coming to shove was our daughter. And they were going to show a sex education film, and she said, "I'm not going to go to that." And she came home and told us about it. Well, I'll pretty well stand behind her on this. And the principal called us, told us about what Jenny had decided to do. I said, "Yeah, she's already talked to us about this." And I said, "She's not going to go watch that film." I said, "Now, you can keep her out of it. I'm sure that you've got other alternatives you can do." Or I said, "I can keep her home. Whatever you want." But I said, "She doesn't want to go watch that, and I'm not going to make her watch that film." I said, and furthermore, I said, "I think the film doesn't do as much to prevent the problem as to put ideas in the kid's head. I think that's a real danger with those kinds of things." He said, "Well, yes," he said, "that's entirely possible, but this is something that, you know, we have to do," and so on. I said, have you ever thought about maybe having something said in all of this about abstinence? I mean, it's all about safe sex. How about some abstinence? That's safe sex, isn't it?" "Oh, yeah," he said, "there'll be something said in the film about abstinence." I said, "How long's the film?" The film was about 30 minutes long. I said, "So let's see, probably 1 minute of abstinence and 29 minutes of something else." I said, "She's not going to that." And she didn't. And she was the only one that didn't go to it. Pretty soon everybody knew why. You think that she might have had an influence? I'm sure people laughed at her. I'm sure they ridiculed her. I'm sure they thought she was the scum of the earth, that it was ridiculous. Probably those kids' parents thought the same thing and so on. But that's what you do. That's the risk you take if you're going to be any kind of an influence at all. Doesn't matter if that's my daughter, whoever, any of us. If we're going to speak up and say that this is something that's wrong and I'm not doing it, then
That's some of it. Now, I think that one of the things that I have no problem with people want to homeschool their kids, that's fine. I think it's a great thing. But I think we have to be cautious that we're not holding our kids away from all other people, and then they have no opportunity to be salt and light. And at the same time, I think to ourselves, sometimes we decide as adults, now not just the kids in the homeschooling, but as adults, well, I can't do this and I can't do that and I can't do... I know there's things that we can't do. And I know that sometimes there's things that we're uncomfortable with in doing or going, or people we associate with or anything like that. But you know what? There's times whenever we're going to have to be with people so we can be an influence. We're not talking about just being an influence with each other. We're talking about being salt of the earth and light of the world, not just of the kingdom. And so we need to be cautious. We need to be careful that we don't just become so isolationist that we lose our ability to be an influence. And we can recognize all these things, and we can handle the situation. There are some situations where we shouldn't be involved in it at all, and there's some that, well, maybe it's something that we can be an influence in. And sometimes, you know, we're going to have to carefully weigh this, kind of like we talked about this morning. We need to have God as our counselor. He tells us that we can overcome these things because we know about them. 1 John chapter 2, verse 15 through 17 tells us about the love of the world, the things in the world, the lust of the flesh, lust of the eyes, pride of life. You can find all those things revealed to us in the Scriptures and how we can influence this. But these things are not from the Father. They're from the world. The world passes away, the lust thereof, but the one who does the will of God lives forever. And that includes being salt and light. And we need to be using ourselves as influence to make a difference. Well, that's a lesson for tonight. Let me just ask a simple question. Are you a disciple of Jesus Christ? Turn to the songs being selected. If you're not a disciple, obviously, you can't be any kind of influence at all. Like it's talking about in Matthew chapter 5, unless you're a disciple. That was for disciples to be an influence of salt and light in the world. So why not become a disciple? Why not just become a disciple, but why not make a determination to live as disciples and really to be an influence for good and for things that are right in the world? So why not obey the gospel tonight by believing in Jesus Christ as the Son of God, repenting of sins, and being baptized? The song has been selected. If you're subject to the invitation, now's the right time. This is the right place. Why don't you come? All together we stand and sing.